Well, hey, everybody, and welcome. I hope you're all doing great. And those of you who are in the middle part of North America, poised for a great Thanksgiving. Thank you for the kind words and follow-up questions from our last seminar. I want to offer a couple of examples to attempt to answer some of the questions and comments and to address earlier questions sort of wrapped in. Two or three examples to hopefully simplify as case examples. The first is an example of how a mindset determines everything that follows and how accurately labeling a feeling determines a mindset. A client I'll call Jana was a professional coach doing mentor coaching with me to enhance her skills, jumpstart her practice. Jana had had a stellar background, both practice and academic, as a therapist prior to making the transition to professional coaching. And her situation, in terms of the framework, she had just gone through a near-miss hurricane experience in her home in Florida. She was feeling exhausted and depleted, partly because she felt unable to say no to a number of people who she knew needed help. And she said, if I see someone in need, I help them. And she was surrounded by people that needed help at that time. I feel bad if I don't help, she added. I'm not able to not do something for them. And I get overextended and exhausted, so I'm not able to even do things for myself or my family or my clients. She said that if she said no to someone she perceived in need, she felt guilty. And that framed a whole cascade of responses that resulted in her feeling depleted and unable to do things even necessary for herself. And we began this discussion of reframing by my observation, and I knew she was very savvy with all of this, being a therapist. I said, I think you're labeling your feeling wrong. And she said, what? And I reminded her that Carl Menninger said, save guilt for real sin. So by labeling her experience of saying no as guilt, that introduced an entire mindset, a whole series of activities designed to address and counter feeling guilty and doing for others to the point of her own depletion. Saying no meant that she considered available possibilities and resources, on the other hand. Instead of guilt, no simply means that she surveyed the possibilities of what she was and wasn't able to do, what her priorities was, and her commitment to her own agenda. No simply meant that she was loyal to her agenda and her commitments. She kept the point of reference herself rather than giving it away to each person in need, kind of like the giving tree, which she was also familiar with. This simple reframing resulted in a loyalty and effectiveness to her own ideals and needs, which she got clear in our brief discussion about this, rather than abandoning them to fit into someone else's request. Simply accurately relabeling what her experience was, not as guilt, but as the stressful response when she abandoned herself, kept her own needs and goals in focus. One more, and this was a specific question, and I think it really deserves an answer. More directly, how can mental framing determine the outcome of what we do or of a performance? First, consider this. What do you think of when I say, don't think of an elephant? Now, that statement is the title of a book by Dr. George Lakoff, a prominent social scientist. That ensures you're going to think about an elephant. Whether the focus is negative or positive, it activates the imagery of an elephant. Neuroscience and quantum physics show us that we get what we focus on, not what we want. And that focus can be determined in a number of ways to enhance performance. So one example is looking, and we touched on this, looking at possibility rather than problem. So most of the brain algorithms are not consciously accessible, but we can readily see their consequences. They're automatic, unconscious, instantaneous. So the emotional and behavioral patterns that we follow are consistent with how we frame the meaning of something. So how you frame a setback has a significant impact on the chance of successfully overcoming it. An obstacle initiates either a setback story or a resilience story of successful performance. A resilient story becomes a triumph of desire. So this is a simple way of thinking about, from a sports analogy, remember that we have two basic motivations of our brain wiring: to seek pleasure and to avoid pain. To play to win is a positive framing that engages seeking pleasure. Significantly better results than when you engage the avoiding pain and play not to lose. So this can have a significant impact as you're listening to your clients frame something and how they proceed and how they and you can learn from them. So one other quick question, then I'll get to a more active discussion. And this is an excellent question. How do you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? Let me ask to manage the background noise, to do mute if you're not speaking, so I don't hear you. I want to keep this as an open mic. So here's how not to do it. Quote from Alexander Wolf in Sports Illustrated: by yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, the coach is probably assured that it will happen again. I'll bet most of you have played the game Taboo. You have a target word on a card that you've drawn, and you want your partner to say your single word clues, from your single word clues, that you can accompany by gestures. You can imagine how hard that is for me. Also, on that card, with the target word, and you want to say as many as you can, you want to get your partner to say as many from the cards in 1 minute as possible. Also on that card, with the word you want your partner to say, there are 6 words that are taboo. You cannot use those 6 words. So the immediate thing you do, I do, everybody, is to focus on those 6 words, and it's like you can't get beyond them. Remember when you play that? It's like, okay, I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to pay attention. You've already engaged it. So a common perception is the best way to get employees or players or clients to perform is by pointing out mistakes or, in certain instances and personalities, making threats or being intense. While negative emotions grab attention, a positive focus works considerably better to develop confidence as a mindset. And this is the framework we use in coaching, one of collaboration. So when someone can reframe mistakes as information to learn from, they can develop skillful coping and resilience, and it can help them relax into a mindset of confidence, keeping calm, carrying on, experiencing effectiveness are the usual ways to instill and enhance confidence. So I hope these are useful illustrations of a number of the questions that you had and comments you had. So thoughts, questions, things you want to add or ask right now before we move into our discussion. What you got? Remember to come off mute, *6 again if you have muted. Anything you want to add or ask or just comment on? If not, I'll deal with my loneliness, and we will move right in to the presentation mode. Final call? Anyone? Okay. I'll get us on lecture mode, and I'll reserve some time at the end if there are comments or questions or you'd like to discuss anything. Okay, we're going to apply what we talked about last time, and initiate a discussion about mindset mapping for growth. So recall from last seminar, state of mind is like a software program that determines what we perceive, how we process information, and how we respond. Our minds constantly monitor and interpret to give us a running account of what's happening, what it means, what to do. And these are the algorithms that operate in that 90 to 95% of our operating system that's unconscious. Is what we perceive and how we process and then what we do are all determined by that software program. So remember, in coaching, you never have to go back into the past. You never have to uncover all of those unconscious, any of those unconscious processes or even the algorithms. If they're important, they'll manifest. A client is always showing us exactly what it's like to be him or her so that we together can collaboratively look at what works and what may need to be addressed. So mindsets frame this ongoing account of what we see, interpret, how we process, what we do. They're powerful. Mindsets are powerful beliefs of the stories we have about ourselves, because the bedrock is identity. Researchers fairly recently at Norwegian University of Science and Technology discovered that the brain creates multiple independent maps while finding its way in the world and responding. So our human brains really operate like a Google map. So rather than one big map, the brain makes a whole series of maps to operate. That's why with these series of maps, we have to provide the continuity, the consistency, the synthesis, the integration. We have to make it consistent with our story instead of just a series of reactions. When we're in a new situation, a new map's booted up. And this explains how we can have different contexts or frames for different situations. So these mindsets or maps are stored in the hippocampus, the part in the midbrain that is memory and imagination's focal point. A mindset is its own world. It's its own software program. It's complete and it's internally consistent. So the mindset comes first. The state of mind determines the meaning you attach to a cue or a stimulus. The meaning then determines your behavior. So, to change your behavior, change the meaning you attach. Remember in last seminar we talked about the three steps to rewire your brain for the neuroscience of change. The illustration I just gave, simply to label a feeling accurately that the upset, the anxiety is not guilt, but it's feeling overwhelmed with the assumption that you ought to be able to do all the things that you want to do for other people that may overwhelm your system and may not be possible. So, mind maps are the brain story. These brain connections influence the reality that we see. Now, we have paradigms roughly synonymous with a mind map. It's a model, a theory, a frame of reference, simply the way we see the world. So what we perceive and understand and interpret is our individual paradigm, our map. And the paradigm is the map that explains the territory. It's not the territory itself. Six people could look at the same situation, the same territory, and each describe it in a different way. Now, we all have a number of maps or paradigms in our head, different storylines. We're often unaware of having them, and we just assume that we see things the way they are. And this is why I emphasized earlier, remember that if you even join me in using this metaphor of listening for the client's story and collaboratively listening for the storylines and how the client constructs a story, remember, for the client, it's not a story. That's our metaphor to understand and to look at things and understand in a better way. For the client, it's not a story. It's just the way things are. So this is part of what we do in working with a client that we develop through our interaction with the client, the entire spectrum of empathic listening, of developing self-reflection, of ultimately developing self-empathy and self-awareness to be able to better regulate. We do this with a client while we're talking about other things because the client is downloading this model of how they may think and reflect on things the other 7 days and 23 hours that we're not on the end of that telephone line or we're not on the other side of the screen. We are helping the client develop a model that will be part of the legacy of this coaching conversation, ways of looking at and understanding oneself in a better way. So we originally construct beliefs because it's simply a way that we make sense of our experiences in the world. And the beliefs then become predictors and then confirm the reality that generates them. And some of you have heard my story about this, but it illustrates it so well. I want to say it again about how we create the reality. Two anthropologists, and this is a study out of Oxford a number of years ago, two anthropologists were chosen to enter separate, essentially identical ape colonies to live and observe for a year. They had remarkable similarities, were chosen because of their similarities of personality, philosophy, training, education. A year later, the two anthropologists, without communicating with each other, emerged to compare notes. And they and their teams expected essential similarities, but instead found remarkable discrepancies. One anthropologist, after an initial period of transition, was accepted by the apes. He was integrated into the colony, achieved a unity and a comfort, got remarkable data. The other anthropologist never got beyond the social periphery of his colony and remained careful and vigilant, always seemed right on the cusp of a conflict, never achieved a harmony, and they reviewed to be sure they had selected and matched the two ape colonies. The anthropologists and their teams could not understand the discrepant result or find any reason. They puzzled for months until they finally found one difference. The anthropologist, who was the uncomfortable, careful, vigilant outsider, carried a gun. Now, his gun never showed. He never used it. The apes never knew he had it. But he knew he had it. He knew if things got tough, he had an out. The anthropologist who had no gun instead had a commitment. He knew from the beginning he was either going to make it or not on his own. In retrospect and reconstruction, each of their assumptions created the reality that they experienced day to day. We tell our story, then our story tells us. So a belief is a feeling of certainty about what something means. If you want to get someone's belief, say, well, how do you know that? And as coaches, we listen, for example, for limiting beliefs that can ghostwrite behaviors. Now, a map reduces the size and complexity of a territory. It's a representation. So rather than each situation being overwhelming or chaotic or a new experience, we shift to an organizing frame of reference, a mind map. And we help a client choose or create a most effective mind map. And we listen for when a client chooses a mind map or software from an earlier situation that may be outdated. We'll look at that together and set about updating in that process. So this is developing self-awareness, the ability to reflect on how we think and what we do. And that means we can learn from our experiences and from the experiences of others. This is why we create a new story, because we are not our old story. We created our old story. We are not our habits or our thoughts. If a client characterizes something that they've repeatedly done as if it were an identity, I think it makes sense to immediately look at that rather than as an identity, as simply a series of choices and look at it from choice architecture. well, you know, I didn't follow through. I'm a procrastinator. Well, two things need to be looked at. If you had a plan, didn't follow through, let's examine that. Instead of bringing closure to characterize it as a kind of consortium of past habit applied here as if it were cause. So these can be helpful to look at. Now, a dilemma means having two or more mental maps in conflict. So we may approach this from coaching at one of a couple of different levels. At a macroscopic level, to look at the mental map that's most productive for a given task, or even developing a meta map. An example, someone feels anxious and uncomfortable about trying something new, about changing. We help them correctly read the anxiety or the uncertainty of a new endeavor as potentially excitement and challenge, and as validation of moving ahead beyond their comfort zone. Their feeling is not intuition that this is a wrong choice or the anxiety that danger's ahead, but this simply is what happens each time we take one step beyond a comfort zone rather than in an old model of repetition and potentially limitation. At a microscopic level, now again, we're not talking like this to clients. I'm talking like this to you guys, but this is just to conceptualize so that you can take this and apply it in experience near language for clients. At a microscopic level, awareness of the choices of this moment and picking the best one. Now, the example I gave, if you label something wrong, you're going to write the wrong story. If you feel guilty about saying no, label it as guilt, then you're going to use a different map than seeing it as if you're setting an appropriate boundary where no simply is a part of a choice because there are other needs and ideals and a bigger plan that you have, so you're taking care of yourself and being loyal to your plan. Now, here's an example of a conflicting mindset. A client of mine, an attorney, was asked by her dad, "I'd like you to be the executor of my estate." His daughter responded, "Well, sure, Dad. First, I'll need to know some basic things about your property and wishes." And he looked at her and said, "Well, that's none of your business." A conflicting mindset. Remember that the map is not the territory. That is, beliefs are not reality, at least not consensual reality. Beliefs are simply the ways and the negotiations we construct to explain to ourselves to deal with our experiences and bring closure to move on. Now, that closure may or may not be accurate, it may or may not be cause and effect, but it's brought closure and we'll tend to repeat it. So we need to recognize that we each create our own stories to be able to take ownership of the stories in order to assess what needs to change, what may need to be enhanced, or even ignored. Now, here's one important thing to consider for us in listening to our client's new story. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing search for meaning. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. Now, discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey, one step beyond the comfort zone. Our brains also have an error detection mechanism. This is a specific anatomical reality in the brain, located very close to the emotional center, that says this isn't normal, or activates in a way when we try something new or see something that is other than what we expect. So when our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns get hardwired and automatic. Then after we've hardwired a pattern, if something is different and doesn't fit that pattern, the error detection mechanism, the brain, is doing its job description to create harmony, to create ease of function, to make things automatic so you can use energy for other things. So a mismatch creates a disruption in the expected order of things. So think about how the error detection mechanism explains a number of dynamic factors. And I'm reviewing this so that you can listen for this to hear if the brain, if the brain of your client is simply predicting something that they're not experiencing, they're creating something new, and they get uncomfortable and feel like, well, this is not the right thing, or, you know, my gut's telling me, my brain's telling me. We notice differences more easily than confirmation, so it becomes easier to focus on the things we do wrong, and at the same time struggle to list our strengths. If advice, which is why it probably doesn't make good sense to really give advice as coaches, if advice is unfamiliar or unwanted or simply unexpected, it can set off the error detection response, meaning that someone can reject an idea before they actually weigh it or consider it, which places another barrier to resist change. So telling a client what to do may trigger the error detection mechanism if it doesn't fit with what they were thinking about or how they see it. Focus on problems energizes because it activates the error detection mechanism. And that's what the brain seeks, is novelty, activation, what's next. And when we focus on problem, think about what's the most common addiction, at least in North America, if not the world. The most common addiction is we always fall back on problems. Think about, you get together with a buddy, you're having a glass of wine. How quickly do you start talking about problems and overcoming problems? How quickly do we think about what can go wrong? What are the things that we need to do to address? How to reverse that today? So the mental maps that were tailor-made for a certain context in our lives, like stress or childhood, simply may not apply in usual situations. Think about the last time you did negative self-talk. You had something really negative to say about yourself. What's the age of that conversation? My bet is that it came from a time capsule that may date back to single-digit years. So when changes occur in a systematic and consistent way, such as with collaborative, contingent conversations, exactly what we do in coaching, new connections are made in the brain. New maps are created. So the brain's error detection mechanism can be used as part of a powerful internal navigation system. So I want to review here because I think it'll be useful for us to consider. In working practically with clients, 10 principles of how the brain operates to facilitate change, and these are in the outline. 1, change generates discomfort. That's exactly what we've been talking about, that any attempt to modify behavior and habits, even if we know intellectually it's a good thing to do, is going to generate discomfort because we're hardwired to repeat the familiar. So think about how you don't have to drive. You don't have to think about driving the same way to work each day. Remember, at least pre-COVID days. And this default mode means you can think about other things, listen to a book. But suddenly, there's construction. You have to snake your way through a neighborhood. It takes energy, takes content. You can't really pay attention to the book. So this is how it's not as easy to disrupt those automatic pilots, and it's work to change. A natural inclination, a job description of the brain is to resist the stress of change, to preserve the default habit. And the brain naturally resists change because it hardwires behavior to save energy. Now, here's the secret your brain doesn't know yet. The promise of change is to develop a new, better default mode. Brain just doesn't know yet, so our minds have to lead the way. And you will have to collaboratively plan this with your clients in instances. some remarkable new research shows that consistently repeating new experiences even alters gene expression. Beliefs themselves can turn genes on or turn them off. And I heard Ray Kurzweil say this, and it's in his book, The Singularity is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology. Civilization advances by extending the number of important operations which we can perform without thinking about them. And that's what we do as coaches to help our clients revise their stories to get to even better operations without having to think about them. And one of my heroes, George Costanza, said, "I love things you don't have to think about." He was on to something. Two, change creates dissonance. We see what we expect to see. In other words, what our radar has been coded for. In fact, when we don't see what we expect, that's when the error detection mechanism says something's wrong. So since this portion of your brain has a job description to recognize and correct errors, consider the emotional expense of a couple of things. A lie. The surface story is the constructed lie. The subliminal story is the recognition of the lie by the error detection mechanism. Then you have to deal with the dissonance. Triple work. Another, debt. The real expense of buying something you can't afford is that you have to pay more for it. Then the emotional expense of the dissonance in your brain because your error detection mechanism reads that you spent what you couldn't afford to buy. Then you have to pay interest on the debt. Triple work there again. Now, you can deceive others, even your own mind, but your brain always knows. Now, the good news here is this mental mechanism, this neural machinery can recognize and correct errors to optimize behavior. So we respond to mistakes. We just have to recognize, and we will have to help our clients at times, recognize the difference between responding to mistakes and responding with the error detection mechanism to change itself. Huge distinction. Three, the brain's a prediction machine. Let me give you some numbers. Write these down if you can. 1, 2, 4, 5, 7, 8. What's missing? Usual answers, 3 and 6, maybe multiples of 3. Consider this. Nothing's missing. I gave you a complete list of 6 numbers. Everything that's there is there. What's missing, if you thought it was, is inside your head. It's informed by a pattern of expectation. Now, this is huge in writing a new story. Sometimes you have to outsmart your brain. When anything recurs 2 times in a row, the brain predicts a 3rd repetition. A stock goes up 2 quarters in a row, so the brain predicts a 3rd rise will follow. J. Paul Getty was onto this. He said that there are 3 elements, key elements to getting rich. Get up early, work hard, find oil. And now you can see how the brain prediction of patterns is also the basis of some jokes, listing a couple of things, then a 3rd non sequitur. The human brain automatically imposes patterns and predictions on repeated events. This can make it a challenge to override both emotion and brain patterns at times to make wise and balanced decisions. This is also, by the way, what you guys get paid for, what we all get paid for. 4, behavioral reinforcements can backfire. Let's say you're the COO of a company determining a policy about employees being on time. Which works better, threats or reinforcements? The answer is neither. Both likely will backfire because both focus on the negative. Threats work short time but draw attention away from work and back to the problem. Recognition for someone being on time actually focuses on late versus not, on anxiety, and reinforces neural patterns that are connected with lateness. So we assume people will receive information about change and use it to better themselves. Not so, says the brain. The error detection mechanism reads, well, this isn't right. And being told what to do results in innate opposition. The brain's natural homeostasis says, avoid change. 5, motivation is not essential. We've touched on this before. Someone does not have to be motivated to do something. And someone may not generate motivation until they set a goal and start moving toward it. Any action can generate its own motivation. Remember I mentioned the professional actors and athletes I work with, they are not motivated to get up and go to the gym in the off season or throughout the year, but they do it because they have a plan and to stick to it. That's all you need. You do not have to be motivated. All you need is a plan and stick to it. An example, you don't have to be motivated to save for retirement. What you can do is create a simple plan of an automatic transfer of X amount of money from your checking account to your retirement the first of every month from now on. One decision, no motivation, you're going to be set for retirement. 6, emotions change brain functioning. Now, when emotions are triggered, brain chemicals of dopamine and adrenaline get released that prompt toward action and away from creativity and assessing knowledge. This is why with clients, especially if they're in a charged or upset or any kind of emotional shadowing even of their experience, it will be helpful to get them grounded and centered. State always before strategy and story. So, as soon as emotion is triggered, reason runs and logic leaves. In fact, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century put it really simply. Everybody's got a plan till they get punched in the mouth. That, of course, was Mike Tyson. So when there is a possibility of reward, dopamine is released to produce an excited state in response to anticipation of that reward. That can be a risky stock investment, approaching a slot machine, a risky but ill-advised, if you really look at it, relationship. So here's an example of what we know now. If someone is hooked up with an fMRI as they approach a slot machine, the spike of dopamine occurs just before they ever touch the machine. It was once thought that dopamine is the reward, the pleasure chemical that's a reward for certain behavior. But it's not. It's the anticipation. Before someone purchases an item or spends money, that's when they get the hit of dopamine. That's why there can be things like the shift to a totally different system, the marathon system that has to pay back money, and buyer's remorse sets in, or at least for the time being, they try to buy something else and to keep those spikes coming. 7, stimulation and performance. Stimulation, also known as just a little bit of stress, can enhance memory and learning. It's kind of an activation, kind of an excitement. The time window, though, is limited, maybe up to 2 hours. The longer periods of time, especially 4 hours or more, things go the other direction. Learning capacity declines. It becomes stress instead of excitement. That means with sustained stress, people can make bad and emotionally charged decisions. And this is why regulation of states of mind and management of emotion is the key secret to success for anyone, as we've talked before. 8. Closure to novelty. Studies show that even highly accomplished people can close themselves to novelty as they get older. The major factor is not their age, but how long they've been doing a particular thing, such as been in a particular business. People who stay in one place in one position can get most entrenched. A place that I see this kind of resistance in coaching is family succession of business. The patriarch founder passes the company he founded 36 years ago to his two children to own and manage. It's a challenge because everyone involved changes roles and relationships. If you don't believe me, just tune in to Succession. Now, these last two principles are huge. Neurogenesis is the creation of new brain cells. Two things above all others create neurogenesis, new brain cells: an enriched environment and exercise. An enriched environment of intellectual and emotional stimulation creates more complex and rich brain tissue to co-create, stimulate thinking, challenge, story bust. This is our job description as mentor coaches. The hippocampus is the part of the brain especially connected with creativity and memory, those two things more than anything else. Mice from an enriched environment had a 15% increase in the number of their hippocampal cells. What's your guess about how much exercise increases cells? Physical exercise increased the number of cells in the hippocampus by almost 100%. And again, this is the site of creativity and memory. Another finding: chronic stress impairs neurogenesis. It goes in the other direction to decrease the number of cells in the hippocampus. And finally, 10, neuroplasticity simply means the brain remodels itself. This has been called the scientific revolution of our time. A region of the brain that originally had one job can be trained to perform another. The brain can reassign job descriptions of neurons. This is like rezoning and developing cortical real estate. When we write a new story and change our minds, we change our brains. Here's a simple example. This is just down the road a piece from me here in Houston. Some NASA astronauts did a training experiment in which they had headgear with a visual apparatus that exactly reversed things. Consistently, 24 hours a day, up was down, down was, everything was reversed. So they had to learn to adjust everything they did. They had to carefully move and think about what they did. Nothing could be automatic. Their brains then, after day 25, they noticed something remarkable. Their brains automatically made the adjustments. Their brains had rewired, had developed new neural pathways. Now, another group of astronauts, same headgear, were given a day off out of the helmets for 24 hours at day 15. When they put the headgear back on, it took them 25 days from that point for them to rewire, to make the adjustments. And I'm emphasizing here the role of neuroplasticity and the role of consistency. The human brain creates patterns of connections in our ongoing attempts to try to find meaning. These patterns, these mental maps, relate to our ability to plan and predict the future. So when our predictions get confirmed repeatedly, patterns become automatic, so we don't have to think about them. The patterns become hardwired and automatic. So I want to close by just reviewing briefly six aspects of mapping change. And these are, I'm going to do it briefly because we talked about each of these, but I want to bring it together. There are six crucial elements to map change with our client, to plan for what changes they want to make so that they can then create the changes. One, regulate states of mind. Remember, states of mind are like software program, and our being able to be grounded and centered means selecting the optimum state for a task rather than with emotion or stress. The emotional brain hijacks. The intellectual logical brain can even hold it hostage. So the first order of business with ourselves, with our client, is to regulate feelings, to get grounded and centered, and to have that self-awareness to engage what we want in the best state of mind to do it. The brain equation for good decisions, right brain, emotional, plus left brain, logical, intellectual, equals balanced decision. That's way too simplistic, but it's still true. The number two element to map changes, the power is in the focus. Remember, we talked about we get what we focus on. We know from neuroscience, from quantum physics, we get what we focus on. And it has to be in a positive way, not just avoiding something negative, because that will bring about also what we focus on. You become what you think. So put energy into what you want. Focus on possibilities instead of problems. Desires instead of obstacles. To fight something, to deny something, is to engage it, to add energy to it. And it creates resistance. But when you focus on what you want, what you don't want falls away, like your lap when you get up to walk. Three, visualize changes. There's a whole section in the resources component of your outline about visualizing, about a neuroscience way to visualize changes, which rewires the brain, and to construct a software revision of positive affirmations that can support the story. And it's a brief chapter, but it's a chapter from Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual. And it's, I think, the last thing in your outline. So when you visualize something, your brain can't tell the difference between what you see from your optic nerve and what you create as imagery. And when you repeat that visualization, you hardwire it. So that may be a strategy with certain clients to be able to overcome a fear of doing something, to be able to create a vision and then strategically back into it. Four, insight changes the brain. If you hook up someone and look at what happens in their brain, at the moment of insight, an aha experience, three different parts of their brain light up, and they're vaulted into a state that is more synthetic and integrative and creative. Now, give them facts, information, instruction, orders. Nothing happened. No part of the brain lights up. So this is what we hope for to sustain engagement and collaboration with clients, that we're helping them to create insights. Five, take action. The world will not pay you for what you know. It will pay you for what you do. It rewards action. To analyze and plan are important, but payday comes with action. Winners develop a plan, set it into motion. It may not be perfect, but it can be organic. They can self-correct and keep moving forward, learn from mistakes, and produce results. This may be why a group of the brightest people anywhere with all kinds of degrees can plan and figure out something, but struggle to make it happen. Meanwhile, and I am quite familiar with such a group. Meanwhile, the guy who almost finished the second semester of community college owns a bunch of real estate on the west side of town. And six, transform identity. A new experience or idea must be focused on consistently and frequently. When brain attention is consistent, brain circuitry is stabilized and ultimately rewires. The mindset of identity then incorporates the new experience to integrate it as part of an evolving self, as part of a new model that the client is co-creating with you of how and who they see themselves. This is what determines whether something that's a change is going to be permanent. If the client transforms how and who they see themselves, their bedrock of identity, as incorporating the new behavior and the concepts and ways of doing it, will become permanent. If they simply treat it as behavior, then they're going to revert back to what they did before, because the most powerful force of the human psyche is identity. We will always revert to our identity. That's the beauty of working in coaching with someone, to help them transform their identity to incorporate their whole experience of success into how and who they are right now. So I want to close in some specific principles to help clients change mind, brain, and behavior. Begin where the client is. resonate with their experience, their challenge. Help them learn more about what they already know. It's just easier that way. A client is very willing to talk about himself or herself, so the more they know, they've begun to develop this self-reflection about something they know before they have to apply it to something new and different that's going to say to the brain, the brain's going to say, this is not right. Highlight positive attributes, existing neuronal networks like natural talents, behaviors, patterns, to encourage their practice. Don't focus on mistakes. That focus will enhance neuronal etching. Remember, you get what you focus on. So mistakes are not what to focus on. Simply to acknowledge, to learn from them, and create a plan going forward that does not involve mistakes. Correct mistaken couplings. Understand and build on existing networks. Meanings that are current, relevant, applicable to now and next, to the system that you're creating. Let sleeping dogs and old unuseful networks lay. Don't engage them. Encourage the client to develop their own metaphors and connections. Stories, analogies, metaphors create maps. You're helping the client assess, revise, and create new stories, new storylines. Moving forward, the brain has an intrinsic desire to create novel connection. The brain is always asking what's next, and when there is a what's next that's proximate, boom, you get a hit of dopamine. Stephen King put this very simply. He said, all a writer has to do to keep the reader engaged is for the reader to keep asking the question, what's next? The client has to recognize and take ownership of experiences. And this is an important aspect, to own something, to own that you're the author of the story, because then you can write a different or revised or new story. When we write a new story and change our minds, we also change our brains. And finally, give attention to a new experience or new way of doing things consistently and repetitively. We're in discussion mode now, if you'll manage the background noise. I'm interested in what you think, any clarifications, questions, or just comments about anything we've talked about.
Hey, Dave, it's Eric. How are you?
Hey, Eric. How are you, my man? Good.
What's going on? All right. All right. I just had a quick question for you. What was the sixth aspect of mapping change? I think I missed something.
The last one was transform identity.
Remember
from the roadmap, which we haven't talked about in this group yet, the seven steps, the acronym for understanding algorithms and change. The final step, P, is program new identity, because that's what makes change permanent. Let me ask for a background check there for anybody who has anything going on, even technostatic, to mute, if you would, star six. Eric, does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I had it all.
You got it all, my man. I know you do. Okay.
Thanks.
Thanks. Other thoughts, questions, things that would be helpful to talk about?
This is Kip.
Kip, hey, welcome. www.kipflock.com. What you doing?
Hey, I'm doing just great, thanks.
All right.
Would you be willing to elaborate a little bit more on why reinforcement doesn't work?
Well, what reinforcement does is draw attention to something. So it will work if you draw attention to the right thing. So if you're looking at working with a client and they do something that works, then you want to highlight that. That's an empathic resonance with their experience, and maybe even taking it to the level of conceptualizing it so that they'll have a better access to it. In the example I gave, it was what's going to work better when somebody comes late. So it was a negative response. So what we know from, let's say, the psychology of influence and neuromarketing is what you may want to do in an organizational setting is that when people submit their expenses on time, to highlight that and to thank the six people who submitted their expense documentation on time, it made it much easier. What we know is that it's going to make it much more beneficial and much more positively responsive for the people who haven't done it. They're more likely to do it the next time because there's that social contagion and the desire to do what other people are doing, especially when it gets positive recognition. So this is how positive recognition can always, most always, work way better than looking at the negative. Playing to win versus playing not to lose. Make sense? It creates a framework. And the framework then determines how we proceed and how we attach meaning and behavior then. Make sense, Kip?
Thank you. It does. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. Super. Great to have you. What else? Who else? Let me answer then a question that came in really early that I haven't gotten back to, because I'm always, as you know, looking for the simplest study or the simplest explanation. This is about why we do what we do as coaches and how we can do it better. A study of college-level tutors was titled, this is in a scientific publication, Why Do Only Some Events Cause Learning During Human Tutoring? The best learning occurred at the point that the student reached an impasse and was ready to receive input. The biggest gains came from engaging a particular challenge or struggle at the time it occurred with the student, not functioning for the student, telling them what to do or telling them the answer or guiding a little bit too heavily. But tutors actually impaired learning when they provided answers and support too quickly, and particularly more so when the student was not at an impasse. So only a challenge can prompt deep learning. This is, a useful parallel because it relates, I believe, to the kind of questions that we have at times with our client. And we learn, for example, as parents, not to take over and keep tying our child's shoe. It would have been easier for both of us to do that, but the child learned frustration tolerance and, more importantly, looked into the mirror of us as the parent to see that we believed in his or her innate ability to learn and to persist. This model then internalized as a belief in oneself and formed a pattern of persistence, which is the groundwork of resilience. So we can think about what we've learned, even for those of us who are parents, what works and what doesn't work. The same effect of asking a question rather than giving information. When a question's asked, it opens an engagement and an inquisition in the receiver to join collaboratively to co-create answers. If you give information, someone receiving is going to immediately compare what they're hearing to what they already believe. And remember, a belief is an anatomical reality in the brain. And I touch on this in the last blog that I did that I mentioned, how can we help someone change their mind? Because when someone hears something they already believe or fits with their belief, they're going to seek ways to confirm it, confirmation bias. If it's something they don't believe or disagree with, then they're going to find ways to refute it. So they immediately engage in ways to refute it. So it has then, in both ways, the opposite effect of just having a conversation to provide new information. In fact, in the latter instance, when someone is more intelligent, more mentally flexible, it'll create the boomerang effect. They will be even more entrenched in their belief that they had that disagrees with your belief because they thought it through and engaged it and sort of locked it in. So these are all, I think, great questions for us as coaches to consider, and I'm hoping to illustrate some of the things that really can provide ways to think about this as coaching, because we're always at this juncture of looking at what we can do to best facilitate, to be the best catalyst for our clients' story development. So thank you all very much. Thank you for your input and for your communication in between, for the kind words, the questions. Keep them coming. Remember, next time, jot down anything you want to talk about or that you'd like to discuss further or you have some ideas about. We'll stay like an additional 15 minutes or so after the top of the hour so that we can have a discussion so that all the questions can be attended to if you're interested in hanging on. So have a great rest of the week. I look forward to picking up right here for our final seminar next Monday. Thanks to all of you. See you guys.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, David.
Thank you.